Hello, and welcome to another episode of the 86 Celtics Interviews podcast from CSNNE.com. I'm Abby Chin. While the 86 team was stacked with future Hall of Famers, All-Stars, etc., the bench played a large role in Boston hanging another banner from the rafters. As we've heard from previous episodes, the green and white practices were as heated as some games, with the bench keeping the talented starting five sharp throughout the grueling rigors of the NBA season. In this episode, we bring you clips from members of that bench, including sharpshooting guard Jerry Seesting, backup center Greg Kite, current Mavs head coach Rick Carlisle, and rookie guard Sam Vincent. First, let's hear the stories of how these players came to the organization. First up, guard Jerry Seesting.
Originally, how I first contacted the Celtics, and I was a free agent, going to be a free agent. I think I made the phone call too early before they were actually supposed to be able to talk to me. And being a player, I wasn't, you know, real up on what the rules were or anything, but I knew I was going to be a free agent. I'd been in a losing situation for about 4 years, and, you know, I'd watched the finals in 85 and thought that they might want a player like me from the standpoint they didn't shoot the ball that well from the outside. And so I didn't really know anybody. I didn't know Bird at the time. I played against Bird and McHale, but I played against Chris Ford, and he was assistant coach. So I tried to get him on the phone, and he came to the phone. I said, you know, if there's any way that you guys would have any interest in me coming to Boston, that's where I want to play. And so I found out later, after talking to Jim, oh, they were in a meeting. I guess they had to bring Chris Ford out of the meeting with, you know, the coaches and their basketball staff. And they had just been talking about me when I called. And so it was kind of very ironic that they were talking about me, and they came in and said I was on the phone. So I don't know, I guess from right off the bat there was some kind of karma going on. But, you know, then he said, well, we'll get back with you. He goes, I'll pass this along or whatever. He didn't really tip his hand at all. He said, thanks for calling, whatever. And so I did hear from Jan a couple days later. We talked. He said there was a lot of interest. And at this point, it was really close to the draft. And he said, call me back after the draft. He goes, then we'll talk and we'll get a little more serious and see if anything can be done. So when the draft came, they drafted Sam Vincent in the first round, who was a guard my size from Michigan State, you know, All-American player from Michigan State. And so I didn't call him back because I thought, well, there's that shot down the river. And then so about 2 days later, Jan called me again and he said, What's wrong? He goes, I thought you were going to call me back. I said, well, you drafted a guard my size. I said, you're not going to have a spot for me now. And he goes, oh, no. He goes, Sam's more for the future. He goes, he's probably not going to be ready to play in the playoffs and everything. So then from there, it became quite an ordeal because I was injured the year before with the Pacers. I missed the last 14 or 15 games of the season with a stress fracture. And so I had to go through a series of physicals, come out here and meet with Casey. And when they finally gave me the offer sheet in those years, the team had 15 days to match. Now it's a lot quicker process. So by the time I signed the offer sheet, it got to where it was right before training camp started and Indiana matched it. And so I told Indiana that I wasn't going to come in. Against my nature, I mean, I was pretty much a rules follower, you know, and all this kind of stuff. My agent, he said, just tell them you're not coming to camp and maybe they'll blink and they'll end up trading you to Boston. He goes, because Boston will offer them probably more than what any other team will. So I held out for a couple of days and didn't go to training camp. And they ended up working out a deal. And I eventually got to Boston and missed a couple of days of their training camp. So that's how I got here. In those years, when we were growing up, the only games that were on TV were, you know, those Sunday games, and the Celtics were on most of the time. So I grew up a Celtic fan being in Indiana, and I grew up an Indiana Pacer fan because they were in the ABA. So I played with the Pacers, were my first team, which was, you know, kind of a dream come true. But then the Celtics, you know, it seemed like a distant chance that I would ever play for them. And so when I got here, yeah, Bird and I quickly became pretty close. We sat by each other on the plane all the time. And, you know, he loved to rib me because Indiana State beat Purdue when we played them in college and stuff. So, you know, we were constantly just jabbing each other all the time about different things about Indiana. And, you know, so it was, and Mikhail too. I played against Mikhail in college. He was at Minnesota and I was at Purdue. So we had a lot of battles with them. So, you know, quickly, you know, felt like I was accepted here. That was about probably the third or fourth day I was here. Baseball playoffs were going on and Larry asked me to practice. We were doing double sessions. He goes, why don't I come down? Why don't we go watch a baseball game somewhere? I said, fine. So there was a place across the street, I guess that was Boylston Street, right by Fenway Park. We'd stay there. Used to be a Best Western there. Now I know there's nothing but high rises and it's a high rent district now. But back then it was almost just kind of an average area town in the Fenway. And so he had me go across to meet him at this gay bar. And I went across. Rick was my roommate. I go, come on, Rick, aren't you coming? And, you know, because Rick didn't have a house here yet. And he was just staying at the hotel during training camp. He goes, no, I got to make a phone call. I'll meet you in a minute. So I went over there for a second. There was nobody in the place. And so I came back to the room. You know, I waited about 15 or 20 minutes. I think I even asked the bartender. I goes, Larry Bird been in here? And he kind of looked at me like I was crazy. I go, well, whatever. People in the East Coast aren't very friendly, you know. And I go back to the room, and Rick goes, I just called before you got here. He goes, you didn't see him? I said, no. He goes, well, he's on his way. He goes, he's late. Go on back. So when I went back the second time, about a half hour later, there was quite a few people in there. And I kind of, as soon as I walked in the door, I kind of figured out what they'd done. So.
And there was no game on in the bar?
No. Well, yeah, there was a TV, but then the next day, Casey Jones was kind of ribbing me, so Bird didn't waste any time in telling everybody what he'd done. So,
here's Rick Carlisle's story.
The way things happened, you know, I came into camp on a minimum make good contract, and you know, lucky for me. Gerald Henderson was sitting out in a contract holdout. Cedric Maxwell was sitting out in a contract holdout. So there were only 14 guys in camp, including four rookies. And so I was getting a lot of reps in practice. I was getting a lot of playing time in the games. And then one night in Worcester, Mass, of all places, we had an exhibition game, and Gerald and Max still hadn't signed. And you know, I had a big game. I had 18 points. And Danny Ainge, who had stepped into the starting role in Gerald's absence, had like 25 or something like that. And I think at that moment they realized, hey, you know, Ainge can be our starter and maybe this guy, Carlisle, can be a roster player. And so, you know, a few days later the trade was made and they traded Gerald to Seattle for a draft choice, and then Max eventually ended up signing. And it took a while for him to get in shape, you know, but that was a great break for me. And so that's how I ended up on the Celtics.
Sam Vincent was a rookie during the 85-86 season.
I remember that being a very exciting day. I think like every collegiate player who is waiting on draft day to figure out if you're gonna get drafted, first of all, and then of course, where you're gonna go, there's some anticipation, but once I got the call and I found out I was going to Boston, I remember it being just a thrilling dream come true kind of experience where, you know, you finally know where you're going, you know, the players you're going to play with, you can connect to the history of the club. So that was a very exciting day. Coming from Michigan State, where that senior year I had a chance to be a scoring point guard and play a lot of minutes and have a certain role. I think initially my immediate thought was, you know, how can I go in and play a role on this team? What is that role going to be? How do I be an effective player for a Boston Celtic team that has, you know, an incredible lineup, just came from an NBA championship. How do I fit in? So I think my initial time as a rookie was really kind of built around just trying to figure out how to fit into this group.
What was it like for the players heading into the season after losing to the Lakers in the 85 finals?
Mick said that the summer when you're a champion and going into the next year, that sure is enjoyable. But that summer of 85 was not any fun losing to the Lakers. But I mean, they were a great team. And you talk about the Hall of Famers that we had here with the Celtics. They had their own Hall of Fame players and had the great, break with led by Magic, and Magic being able to go in and rebound with the forwards and send Worthy off on the fly, then be able to play so well in the half court. So they were just a tough opponent, and so I mean, there's no shame to lose them, but you lose it at home was definitely not any fun. And so we were looking out for them, and I think it was the next year, or may have been the 85, it may have been the start of that 85 season. Yeah, I think it was. We played the Lakers four times in exhibition. I realize that sold tickets, but I don't know who ever thought about scheduling that. And you talk about exhibition season, it was heated in those exhibition games. There was even one of those games in the Forum where there was a pretty good fight that broke out. So the rivalry was definitely intense.
The loss in 85 was very difficult. You know, the series with the Lakers was very polarizing. You know, we had game one, we won by 40 points in the Memorial Day Massacre. Of course, when a team wins by that much, they feel, there's always going to be some kind of a letdown. And then the Lakers got pissed and they kicked our ass in game two. And then we went out there and they beat us in game three. We won game four. Game five was tight, but we lost. And so, we were coming home down 3-2. And then they beat us in game six. And, to have the Lakers beat the Celtics, on the Celtics home court to win the championship is a bitter pill, particularly, that was my rookie year, but I got a real lay of the land up to that point, and being around Red Auerbach and Larry Bird and guys like McHale and Parrish, and DJ, this wasn't going to fly. And so there was some upheaval, the roster changed. Maxwell was traded for Bill Walton. And, next year our team came to training camp with a real resolve. And it was a much differently structured team, really by virtue of the fact that Bill Walton was such a great player. I mean, him off the bench now made all of us guys that were playing off the bench, this much better. And, our starting team was healthy that year.
Bill brought a whole different element. But number one and foremost, he was finally healthy for the first time in a long time. He played in 80 or 81 of the games, I believe. He didn't miss much at all that year, practice or games. He was having the time of his life because he was around. He's on a good team again. He was a great teammate. He was ready to play every single day. Practice and games, and all the other stuff. The guys, because just like we talked about last night at the event that we had, Bird, and I was included in it. Bird, McHale, Ainge, these guys, Bill Walton playing for UCLA in the early 70s was, he was incredible, one of the greatest college players ever, and then won the championship. So everybody was kind of in awe of him, but at the same time, because of all his idiosyncrasies and his Grateful Dead and his a lot of his crazy friends that would come around to the games with us all the time, he became kind of the punching bag for those guys all the time too. He would give it right back, but it just kept things alive, and he added so much to the team because he wanted to win so bad and win the championship. That's why he came here. I think it just energized the whole team when he came.
The impact that Walton had was huge. And the other acquisition that we made that year was Jerry Seesing. We acquired him from Indiana. And so, off the bench, you had Bill Walton coming in. It was Seesing, myself, Scott Wedman. And, sometimes we would play, sometimes Greg Kite would play some. But Walton so solidified our second unit so much that oftentimes, you know, the starters would get a lead and we could extend the lead. And now these guys were getting some rest. See, the previous year in 85, those guys were all playing upwards of 40 minutes or even above. They were worn down by the end of the year. And so, you know, something had to change. And Walton changed the world for us. And, you know, all of a sudden guys like me could be on the court and be effective because we had a rim protector, a great passer, a guy that could score on the inside. And a guy really was one of the greatest centers in the history of the NBA. And that was a magical season from the standpoint of health and everything else with Bill, because Bill played 80 out of 82 games, I believe. And, you know, it turned us into a different team. Bill was, you know, one of the most unique figures in sports history for a lot of reasons. You know, political reasons. You know, he was closely associated with the Grateful Dead, you know. And as a little side story, this was one of the things that bonded our team early in 86. The Dead was coming to Worcester, you know, my place, to play. And so Bill went to Worcester the day of the show, and he had invited the whole team. So like 8 of us came. And Bill had the stage set up so that there were like 8 seats on the stage to watch the Dead. And it was my first Dead show. You know, Kevin McHale had an interest in the Dead because he's from the Dylan sort of side of music. Bob Dylan was actually from Hibbing, Minnesota, where Kevin is from. And so Kevin knew a little bit about the Dead. You know, it was myself, Kevin, Scott Wedman, Larry, I think Robert Parrish was there, Seasting was there, Ainge may have been there. And I forget who the other guy was. It was either DJ or Greg Kite or something like that. And so this was, you know, a cultural experience that, you know, could not be described. I mean, you know, it really couldn't. And they put on a great show. And then, you know, the Dead always had an intermission in their shows. And so during the intermission, you know, we all go back to their green room or whatever. It was in Worcester, it was a room that was a real big room. And one of the really iconic images, you know, from that night was in that room, sitting over to the side at a little table with 2 chairs, just sitting there talking, was Larry Bird and Jerry Garcia. You know, and look, if you think about, you know, folk rock music, there's no more greater, bigger cultural icon than Jerry Garcia. And if you think about the NBA and what Bird meant to the league and to Boston and to the basketball world, you know, there's no bigger basketball icon there either in our sport. And to see those two guys just kind of sitting there, they just kind of gravitated toward each other, and they're just sitting there quietly talking, and would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that conversation. So, you know, Walton enriched us in some different ways. He was a big personality. He had a big house in Cambridge, which is, you know, a very political area, a very opinionated part of Boston, the world. And it was just all very, very appropriate for what was happening with the team at the time. And he brought us a big personality on the court as well.
Craziest Bill Walton story. Well, let's go through the list. Bill was a lot of fun, a lot of energy. And I'll tell you a fun one. We had, you know, the Players Association that year had done a session. They had people from John Hopkins come in, John Hopkins Medical School, University, to teach players how to do interventions. So if you had a teammate or a family member or a friend in trouble with drugs or alcohol or something like that. So, and we did role play with this one session after practice. So during the rest of the year, we had a lot of fun with some fake pseudo interventions, like when Danny's jump shot, you know, was when he was in a slump, we'd have an intervention to try to find Danny's slump jump shot and help him out. But, you know, Bill had this long history of kind of being, you know, knowing a lot of the Berkeley crowd and knowing some folks on the left. And there was the rumor when he was in Portland that he had gotten questioned about Patty Hurst because the guy, Jake Scott or something, knew he was affiliated with Patty Hurst. And so we had an intervention with Bill about Patty Hurst. He said, Bill, we love you. We care about you. we saw Patty peeking out of your window, your basement window. So it was great. Bill, we could have fun with Bill with stuff like that. He was a lot of fun. And we rode him hard, but his sense of humor is great, you know, sarcasm and wit but I tell you, you know, Bill, as far as a player, a great, you know, just out there on the court, just the execution and the fundamentals and Kevin used to get on him about these mechanical moves he had. He said, you know, Kevin, he said, Bill, you need to get some space age moves in the post, but hey, what the moves that Bill made were right on spot and the passing, you know, just incredible passing. And I tell you, even as banged up as Bill was with all the surgeries and the injuries, even at that point, he was the best rebounder that I'd ever seen as far as being able to get a rebound, the timing, get a rebound off the rim just as quick as it was available. Bill's presence, you know, we were already a great team and already had a lot of experience, but his presence meant so much to helping that team to become what we like to think of as the greatest team of all time, or certainly in the conversation.
Oh yeah, his wife, she hired, it was his birthday, and the funny thing about that, so all of a sudden, KC, she must have gone through KC, he was the only one that knew. He said, okay, everybody down here, Bill, you got to sit in this chair right here. We got something a little special for you. He goes, it's Bill's birthday, everybody. And so all of a sudden through this girl came this belly dancer girl that came out and, you know, she's gyrating all over the place and we're all hooting and hollering. The Mormon guys were down, they had to shoot basket down the other end, they couldn't watch. But that was a funny part of it too. Danny and Greg Kite were down at the other end and so we were laughing and yelling at them almost as much as we were hooting and hollering at Bill. But it was every day you didn't know what was gonna happen when you came into practice.
While Bill Walton had an impact on the bench, the foundation of the Celtics' success was built on the legendary starting five. Here's C. Sting talking about point guard Dennis Johnson.
Dennis was, he was a huge part of the team. I mean, big playoff game, big game player. I mean, he elevated his game. If it was a regular season game against Philadelphia or Lakers, he was always in a much more serious, he's a happy-go-lucky kind of guy and just a great teammate, great guy. But on those big games, he was a different guy when he'd come into the locker room. You could kind of tell. He was quiet. He didn't joke around much. Other nights, if we're playing, one of the worst teams in the league, he might take the night off, to be quite honest. I mean, he knew we were going to win the game, and he's a veteran, been around, play a lot of games, knew the game didn't mean much, we were going to win no matter what. He might take the night off. And, you know, he's playing, but he's not going to be the same guy as he's going to be in a game four in the playoffs or even playing the Lakers in a regular season game. And players that can do that, there's not too many guys that can do that, turn it on and off when they want to, but that's how good he was. He'd average 14 in regular season, that's average 20 in the playoffs.
Rick Carlisle talks about a big moment for him against the Lakers and how DJ went out of his way to recognize the second-year player.
I was a second-year player. The first year I had played some, and I'd had some success playing early. But as the year went on, you know, the more experienced guys were getting the minutes and stuff. But second year, you know, with that unit with Walton and Seasting and Wedman, and usually they'd bump McHale or Parrish back in with us. So, you know, we really had a formidable front line, and the guys off the bench could play effectively. That game was huge because, you know, during that period, that game in February was always a meaningful game because it probably was going to tip home court in the finals one way or the other. The Lakers and Celtics were that close. And so, you know, I had four or six points in the first half. And then the second half, there was the shot as the shot clock's winding down. I, you know, hit a kind of a turnaround Hail Mary over Worthy. And, you know, it was a huge moment. And we won that game. And I remember after the game, you know, one of the most meaningful moments in my career was, you know, Dennis Johnson came up to me. And really, up until that point, you know, I'd been the kind of the young guy, whatever. But that contribution to that team at that moment, you know, DJ came up to me after the game. He looked me at me and he said, "Hey, that's a hell of a job." And I was just, you know, I was trying to play it cool, but I was like, wow, you know. And so that was huge.
Kite talks about his time backing up Robert Parrish.
Chief and I got along well, and I'm sure he didn't always relish the fact of me banging on him and leaning against him in practice. But he was just a great example of a consummate pro, and the way he worked hard, the way he ran the floor hard, and he was just such a tough player. You know, he had that great shot, and you couldn't get to it. Very rarely saw it blocked, and so Chief was really, really a cornerstone for us. You know, him being as good of a player as he was, offensively and defensively, really enabled and freed up, you know, Larry and Kevin to do hand the guards, to do many more things. But Chief was. It was great. We had that center union brotherhood there.
The cornerstone of the Celtics was, of course, Larry Bird. Greg Kite and Bird were close, and now Kite shares some stories on number 33.
Well, obviously, a lot of Bird stories, but we were talking the other day, reminded of this story where we're playing in New York, and New York had Johnny Newman, who was a pretty good small forward, played in the league a long time, and we come in the locker room at halftime, and Chris Ford goes, "Man, we gotta Johnny Newman's got 10 points. We gotta really get after him, shut him down, and pay better attention to him." And Larry says, we call him Doc. He said, "Doc, I got 24. What do you think they're saying over in that locker room over there?" Here's another little small story with Larry for those years. Mike Saunders, longtime trainer with the Knicks. One time we were playing in New York, and Saunders, I guess Larry had been out early to do some shooting or something, and Saunders, kidding around with Larry, says, "I'll bet you $5 that you won't bank in a three-pointer during the game." Larry said, "You're on." So I imagine Larry just probably didn't even think about it, but forgot about it. But anyway, we get in the game, it's a close game, and there's like 45 seconds left, and there's a dead ball. And Mike Saunders catches Larry's eye and smiling and goes, "Going five, like, I got you." And sure enough, like the next trip down, we're down 2 points. Larry shoots a three and banks it in and turns around and goes five. just all kinds of stuff. Just Larry, you know, as far as confidence on the court, you know, being willing to take the last shot and the big shot or any shot, but, master at stealing other guys' brainwaves on some of the other teams. Talk a little bit of trash to him, he was always telling the guy, you know, "You're big guy, hey, you're too short." He'd shoot the ball and it's on the way in, and then going to net, too short, or little guy, too small, too old, too slow. Or sub would come in the game and he'd say, the guy who's going to guard him, and say, "Boy, your coach must not like you, putting you in the game to guard me." So. That was fun.
Larry, I thought, was a guy who, you know, once he got on the floor, he might do a little trash talking, but it was all in a very competitive kind of way. Whereas Kevin would be trash talking before the game, during the game, after the game. It just never stopped. So that dynamic of those two, everybody else just kind of folded around. You know, Danny kind of knew his spot and folded in. And as the rookie, I was always observing it, trying to understand exactly what was going on. Dennis, who was such a key part of that team and a key part of the success, and has such a strong personality and will, was not as vocal, but was very much a big part of the heart and soul of that team. So there was a lot of strong characters and strong personalities and a lot of strong will and very competitive guys. That created just this incredible balance to really form a very strong team.
Sam Vincent talks about what Danny Ainge brought to the team.
Danny was a little bit of the class clown a little bit, but in a fun way. He was the guy who would take your shoes and tie them in knots, and you know, he put something in your shorts before the game. Someone that I think everybody on the team appreciated, because in a year that had some tension, just because of what we were trying to achieve and where we were going, and you know, the buildup from all the wins, especially at home, Danny was the guy that would do something fun. He was the guy that would always interject some way to release some of that tension. So he always, whether it was, you know, picking on one of the players or finding a way to bring some amusement into practice or game, he had that personality.
An important factor that led to success was the recognition of everyone's place on the team.
There was never any rivalry about who was going to start, who was going to play. Everybody knew their role really from day one. You know, Wedman, me, Walton, all of us on the bench knew exactly what we were supposed to do. So there was never really, it was competitive in practice just from the first team and the second team, but there was no competition or jealousy on playing time or who was going to start and who wasn't going to start, which you see with a lot of teams.
As a player on the Celtics during that time, there was going to be a 8-9-man rotation that KC was using the majority of the time. So there was about 3 or 4 of us who were always, you know, trying to get more playing time. And the reason we always felt important to this team was because Coach Jones had a way of making you understand that it wasn't only the superstars that scored 30 points or the guys that passed them the ball. It was also the guys on the green team that challenged them every day, that played hard in practice. They were also a very big part of the team. So those green and white practices where they were my outlet, and some of the other guys who maybe didn't play as much during the game, but had a way of feeling like we were still creating some contribution to the team.
Head coach Casey Jones obviously played a huge role in setting the team dynamic.
Bill Fitch, before Casey, was a very good coach. He was more of a taskmaster. A lot of those guys will, you know, they can wear, because pro basketball is what it is, there's so many games and you're with around people so long, you know, certain coaches can, that abrasive type of coaches can wear on teams a little bit. And I know, usually they go from a coach like that to more of a player's coach, or vice versa. If a team is not having success after a while with the player's coach, they usually go to a more disciplinarian type coach. And so that's kind of what Boston did. KC had been the assistant coach here, a former NBA player himself, had been an assistant a couple places. So he kind of was more on the player side in terms of knowing what they were going through on their day-to-day things, how hard the travel was, their body needs rest maybe a little more, didn't practice quite as hard. You know, he had a veteran team, older guys, so he was perfect for our team. And even though he was kind of a man of few words, especially from a head coaching position, he had a very competitive nature at the same time, and everybody knew that. He knew what buttons to push when he had to. But for the most part, our team was so driven and had so many veteran guys and had so many guys with leadership that had either been captain at another team, you know, Bill, myself, Wedman had been an all-star at another team. When they come in here, we had so many guys. And then you look at what everybody did after they played, you know, being coaches, being general managers around the league, that, you know, he really didn't have to motivate us. I mean, everybody knew from day one of training camp that if we didn't win the championship, the season was going to be a failure. So there was no real, he didn't have to motivate us or give any Newt Rockne speeches before any games or at all. So he was perfect for us.
One of the things that I always thought was undervalued a little bit was, you know, Coach Jones's ability to manage that 86 championship team. There's always a lot of talk about Coach Phil Jackson and how he managed some of the dynamic egos later with Rodman and Michael and Scotty and some of these things. But I think KC actually did a little bit of that earlier with the egos that we had with Larry and with Chief and with Dennis and with Danny. And I think he was able to do that because KC was just such a strong-minded individual, first of all. And then I think his basketball experience as a player at such a high level at San Francisco and also with the Olympics and some of the guys he had played with just kind of uniquely made him understand the dynamics of the personalities and also able to put them into positions on the floor that were in the best interest of the team.
You know, the Lakers got through their first round and second round. Then in the third round, they played Houston. They ended up getting beat 4-1 or something like that. Won the first game, then Houston won 4 in a row. And so, you know, the big matchup with Boston and L.A. did not happen.
That was disappointing, I think, for everybody. Because all season long, you know, we had focused on the Lakers. With the two games that we played, you know, we put big emphasis on both those games. We beat them pretty good in L.A. on the first matchup and then beat them here. So we swept both games, and we just assumed that would give us a lot of confidence and a little leg up when we played them in the finals. And, yeah, I think we were all kind of just surprised and a little bit let down that they weren't the team that we ended up playing that year. Because that's, I knew, I wasn't here the year before, but I knew that's who the other guys wanted to play.
There was some, maybe, I won't say disappointment, because I think the team was excited to be in the finals. But I think there was always such a excitement around the Celtic-Laker rivalry that there was this, you know, kind of anticipation and hope that, you know, Magic and the Lakers would be there. So I remember that time being still pretty, you know, pretty intense. The guys were still, you know, pumped about being in the finals. But maybe just a little bit down that we were playing Houston versus playing Los Angeles.
Most of the league was trying to get big and match up with the Celtics. I mean, to win the championship, you had to beat the Lakers or the Celtics, and the Lakers were always bringing in, you know, a variety of guys, size guys, to try to match up with Parrish and McHale and Bird. So, you know, they were the kind of team that could possibly give us some problems. I mean, it was a good team. I mean, it wasn't a total fluke that the Lakers lost to them. I think the Lakers probably had a little internal problem maybe after we beat them both times, that they were trying to figure out, you know, what was wrong with their team or whatever was going on out there that year. They really weren't themselves, and Houston upset them. And, you know, you have to play who you're going to play, so now we have to play Houston. But we knew it wouldn't be easy. It would be our tougher, you know, our toughest opponent so far.
You never know anything for sure. I do believe that our team had a healthy respect and appropriate fear for them as an opponent. They were a younger team that had gotten hot and gotten on a roll. You know, we believed that it was our championship to lose. I think, but we also understood, because of our experience, that you could leave nothing to chance. You know, there was one game that had some controversial things happen with officiating on the road. I believe it was game five or game three or game five, one of the two. And so, you know, we felt we should have been up 3-1, you know, at one point. And that was another thing that just strengthened our resolve as a team. And I think the truth was, you know, Houston was a great team in terms of their talent. They had gotten it going at the right time. You know, Fitch was the former Celtics coach, so there was a little something going there. But their inexperience, you know, they just, you know, they needed to go through that moment to probably win it. And you know, we just felt like this was our time, our moment, and our team was not going to be denied. And Larry Bird, you know, I remember him leaving the locker room after game five in Houston. You know, he just had a look in his eye like, you know, let's get it on for game six. Let's go. I'm ready to go right now. And he was phenomenal in that game. The Garden crowd was beyond belief. It was one of those hot ones, you know, which are, those Junes in Boston Garden during the finals, when it gets hot like that, it's unlike any other scene in sports. And, the way that game went, it was dominated really from start to finish. And it was, in my mind, I don't know of a better team on a one season basis in the history of the NBA. And I follow the history of the game and I respect the history of the game. But that team was extremely special.
The Celtics defeated the Rockets in six games, and the memorable season ended with yet another championship.
Well, the feeling, you can't beat the feeling, and I think the journey there to that feeling of being a champion, like I said, all those memories, all that camaraderie and all the hard work and all the fun that we had getting there and just and challenging ourselves and pushing ourselves. Obviously we lost that home game pretty early in the year, I think in December. But I don't know if we may have talked about trying to go undefeated at home, but I do remember one of our goals, besides always having the best record, was that we would never lose two games in a row. And I don't think that hasn't been done in the NBA. And we came very close to it. I think we got down to the final week or something and lost two. But the joy of and excitement of being a champion and an NBA champion and world champion just unmatched. I just remember the great feeling, everybody rushing the court, and I was out there at the end, and I'd seen Danny and Gerald Henderson go after the game ball in 84, so I was out there and got it in 86 and ran off the court, and you don't see that these days. They control the court mob, but I got off the court with that, and that was a lot of fun, and later gave it to Dave Cowens. Dave put it in a few years later in the New England Sports Hall of Fame.
I mean, that's what we, all of us from day one of training camp were, that was the day that we were all looking for. But, it was a crazy atmosphere, obviously, in the locker room after. I know, the seven of us that weren't in the game, we basically had the end of the bench. It got to be a blowout towards the end. The security guys and the police came and got us and took us in the locker room. So I wasn't even on the court when the final horn sounded. We were in the locker room already celebrating, and then the other guys came in. And, the funny thing, though, the emotion that I had was, everybody was partying and crazy, but it was kind of a letdown in that it was over. So that was one thing I remember. I was like, what am I going to do tomorrow? I don't want this to end.
The Houston series was a good series, and in the end, we dominated it. And that celebration was unlike anything I've ever been involved with. The importance that team placed, on their place in history, because it was a team that was not getting any younger. And 86, with Walton healthy and everything in place, was our time. And so, everybody followed through on that, and in the end, I can promise you this, there were a few beers had after the championship game in Game 6 against Houston.
As we have documented in previous episodes, the celebration following the 86 title was short-lived, with tragic news surfacing about Len Bias.
It kind of all started with Len Bias. I mean, if he would have come in here, I think those other guys would have been pretty healthy, because they wouldn't have had to play near as many minutes. So it was just like, it just snowballed from that on. He was going to be, I don't know how many years that guy was going to be on the All-Star team, but he was going to be a great player. In college, he was as good as Jordan in college, I thought. Just an unbelievable athlete, great competitor. And to come in here and to be around the guys he was going to be around, he would have learned right off the bat.
That was, obviously a pretty tragic time. I was the one who spent time with Len Bias when he came to Boston. So I was with him the night before and attended several events with him the day that he flew out. And remember saying to him, this is a great organization. You're going to be an incredible player here. and I'm so excited that I'm not going to be the rookie. So there was a lot of, you know, anticipation about Lynn and what he was going to bring to the team. And I think had he been here, it would have had a completely different chain of effects that would have happened in terms of him coming to Boston and being a great player and giving us that next superstar to build on. So that next day was very disappointing, obviously, and very tragic, and also one of those, you know, memories that, you know, as a member of the Celtic family, you never forget.
Once that happened, I mean, we still had the guys coming back, but guys just started breaking down. I mean, you know, those guys have played so many games for so many years, their season going from, you know, training camp through June, year after year after year. That's like playing a couple extra seasons than the rest of the league. So, you know, it was unfortunate. You know, we still got to the finals, but if we'd have been healthy, you know, I don't think there's any question we would have probably won that year. And if we had Lynn Bias, I probably would have won two or three or four more championships while McHale and Bird were still here. So things changed quickly.
So where do the 86 Celtics rank among teams like the Jordan Bulls or the current Warriors?
Well, it'd be a great contrast of styles. You know, the Bulls teams had kind of segued the league to a different era in terms of basketball strategy with the triangle offense. Their game had moved to a more perimeter dominated game with Jordan and Pippen and a lot of great shooters. I'm sure they would have been great games, but I'm pretty sure we would have won. I'm going to give you my opinion. I really think we would have won.
We would have been one of those 70-plus teams. You know, they talk about there's only, you know, the Bulls and now Golden State, you know, is the only two to ever reach 70. There's no question in my mind that team could have won 70 games. Like I said, you know, it takes a certain level of focus and you've got to squeeze out, you know, those inconsequential wins on the night where you're just a little bit tired. You got to focus a little bit tougher and get those wins. And we just didn't have that focus at that time. But surely that team was one of the teams that through history could have reached that 70-win number.
You know, the argument is always going to be, were the Bulls team the best, the Warriors team this year the best, the Celtics, we're in that conversation. And, you know, there's no way to win the argument because the teams can't play each other, obviously. But, you know, everybody can have their own opinion. The way I feel, everybody can have their own opinion of it. But the facts are, we had five Hall of Fame players on our team, and we had two other guys, Danny and Wedman, that made the All-Star team at one point. And those other two teams can't come close to saying that. So I think that bodes well to how we would do.
Having a chance to have, you know, watch that Bulls team and fully understand Michael, having a chance to see Steph currently and what he has with Clay and Draymond and that group, I believe that this Celtics team would have beat both of those teams. And I say that mainly because, you know, if you just look at 5-on-5, you know, Larry Bird, Kevin, Dennis, Danny, Chief, that's a pretty incredible five. But the X factor for me is Bill Walton coming off the bench. When you look at Golden State now, they've got, you know, two pretty dynamic fives that come off and play for them. But I don't think they're as dynamic as Robert Parish and Bill Walton.
That wraps up this episode of the 86 Celtics Interviews. There's still a couple more episodes to go. Look for them on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You can find out more about this special podcast series on csnne.com or by searching for the 86 Celtics on Audioboom, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcasting apps. I am Abby Chin. Thank you so much for listening.